Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Katie Weaver, Mario Ritter, and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
It has been more than 7 years since the nuclear accident in Fukushima, Japan. Now, tour organizers are bringing tourists to the area. People are slowly returning to the area where the disaster struck. Many hope that visitors will help bring back towns there, and increasingly ease fears of radiation.
Takuto Okamoto operates tours through the area. He brings groups 2 times a month to places like Tomioka, a town 10 kilometers from the wrecked power plant. The disaster happened. The issue now is how people rebuild their lives, Okamoto said. He wants to increase his tours to 2x a week. The area around the Fukushima Daiichi power plant is not fully back to normal. Electronic signs on the highway to Tomioka show radiation levels 100 times normal background levels. Louis Ching is a 33-year-old programmer from the Philippines. He, 2 other Filipinos, and a Japanese man who visited Chernobyl each paid about $209 for the trip from Tokyo. Ching said about his visit, "For me, it's more for bragging rights, to be perfectly honest."
The group visited another town, Namie. It is only 4 kilometers from the disabled nuclear plant. Residents began returning after officials lifted restrictions, but only 700 of 21,000 people have returned. Mitsuru Watanabe is a former resident who owned a restaurant in town. He is 80 years old now. He and his wife Rumiko have no plans to return. They returned only to clear out the restaurant, which is the same as it was when they fled the area in 2011. But he did not want people to forget about the area. "We want people to come. They can go home and tell other people about us," he said.
Okamoto's tour group also traveled to the coast where the deadly tsunami killed hundreds of people. Empty rice fields, empty houses, and a school were all that remained. The area is at the edge of the restricted radiation zone. A new seawall has been built to replace the one destroyed by the tsunami. Fukushima Prefecture plans to build a memorial park there. It will have a center that will show videos and exhibits, as well as hold records related to the earthquake and ocean waves of 2011. Kazuhiro Ono is the prefecture's deputy director for tourism. He said The Japan Tourism Agency will fund the project, while TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, will provide materials for the archive. He said it will be a starting point for visitors. Ono wants foreign tourists to come to Fukushima. While Japan has seen a 200% increase in tourism from 2011, the area has seen very few visitors.
Hidezo Sato is the first person to return to the town. He hopes more tourists arrive. If people come to brag about getting close to the plant, that can't be helped, but at least they'll come, he said. Sato said the archive center will help ease people's fears about radiation. But Mayumi Matsumoto is uneasy about the park and archive plans. The 54-year-old lives in a rebuilt farmhouse with her family. We haven't gotten to the bottom of what happened at the plant, and now is not the time, she said. The cleanup of the Fukushima Daiichi plant, including removing the nuclear fuel, could take 40 years and cost billions of dollars.
Matsumoto had come back for a day to hold a rice planting event for about 40 university students. Later, they toured Namie on two buses, and they visited the place where the park is expected to be built. Matsumoto described her feelings about Tokyo Electric as complicated. She feels the company was responsible for the disaster, but it also helped her family afterwards. One of her sons works for the company, and he has faced angry residents. She said, "It's good that people want to come to Namie, but not if they just want to get close to the nuclear plant. I don't want it to become a spectacle." Okamoto is the only guide offering tours to the area, and there are very few visitors. But Okamoto says he hopes that the people he brings will not only take pictures, but understand the extent of the damage caused by the disaster. I'm Mario Ritter.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
Imagine that you are visiting a friend in Washington, D.C. Your friend takes you to a popular restaurant. You look at the menu and decide what you want, crab cakes. Your friend is taking a little longer to decide. So when the server comes to your table, your friend tells you to order first. You say,
"Hi, I want the crab cakes, please."
Although you expressed your request clearly, it is best to avoid using want when making polite requests. Instead, we use would like. This is just one of many uses for the modal would in everyday speech. A modal is a helping verb that is usually used with another verb to express ideas such as possibility, necessity, and permission. Today we will tell you some of the uses of wood. Let's return to polite requests. At restaurants and other places where we pay for services, a common way to make a request is using would like. This phrase means to wish to have. Listen to the polite version of the food order.
Hi, I would like the crab cakes.
We also use would like in polite offers. When we do this, we use question form. Here is how the server might respond.
Sounds good. Would you like anything else with that?
Yes, I'd like the side salad. Thanks.
Along with food orders at restaurants, you may also make a polite request for someone to do something for you. Listen to this line from a famous television ad for a fruit-based spread.
Would you please pass the jelly?
To many native English speakers, using will in such a request sounds demanding rather than polite or neutral. There are other polite ways to ask someone to do something. In an earlier program, we told you about indirect questions. One of them includes the phrase, "Would you mind?" If we use this phrase, the jelly request becomes,
"Would you mind passing the jelly?"
Common yes responses to such a request include, "No, not at all," and "Sure." Another everyday use of would is in reported speech. We use reported speech to tell others what someone else said without using their exact words. In reported speech clauses, would is the past tense of will. First, listen to will in direct speech.
I will bring the drinks, Anita said.
When we change this to reported speech, we change will to would.
Anita said that she would bring the drinks.
Another example of changing tenses in reported speech is when talking about the weather. Imagine that you are listening to a weather report on the radio. The reporter might say,
"It will be sunny in the morning, but we can expect rain in the afternoon."
Here is how you might tell someone else about what you heard.
The weather report said that it would be sunny this morning, but rainy this afternoon.
Another everyday usage of would is in unreal conditionals. These conditionals describe what we would do in imaginary or unreal situations. You may remember from an earlier program that unreal conditionals have two parts, the if clause and the main clause. The word would goes in the main clause. Here's an example.
I would move to Japan if I spoke Japanese.
In this statement, the main clause comes before the if clause. But the order of the clauses does not change the statement's meaning. You could also say, if I spoke Japanese, I would move to Japan. Sometimes, in casual spoken English, we leave out the if clause in unreal conditional statements, but its meaning is understood. One situation when we do this is when giving advice.
How are you getting to Boston?
We're flying out on Friday.
Nice. I would arrive 2 hours before departure. The DC airport is usually crowded on Fridays.
The understood meaning is, if I were you, I would arrive 2 hours before departure. Past unreal conditionals also contain would, but they are more complex and require a strong understanding of present and past perfect verb tenses. You can read more about these conditionals in an earlier episode of Everyday Grammar. Let's move to something a bit simpler. We also use would in everyday speech to talk about repeated actions in the past. This usage is called past habitual. Here's an example.
When I was little, I would play hopscotch with my friends.
There are two rules for this usage. The first is that we must state the time period in the first part of the sentence. When I was little, for example. Second, we only use would this way with action verbs, such as play in the hopscotch example. We do not use it with stative verbs, such as live, be, know, think, understand, or want. We could not, for example, say, when I was little, I would be happy playing hopscotch. Well, we've given you a lot of information. Would you like to practice now? Join us again soon to learn about more ways we use would. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Franklin Roosevelt's first 3 months as president was one of the most exciting periods in American politics. Roosevelt entered the White House in March 1933. The nation was in crisis. Banks across the country had closed their doors. The Great Economic Depression was at its lowest point. Roosevelt and the Congress moved quickly to help people with little food or money. They launched a series of major economic programs. I'm Doug Johnson with Mario Ritter. We talk about the laws and policies of President Franklin Roosevelt, including those known as the Second New Deal.
Conditions improved within a year after Roosevelt took office. There was no question about that. Banks were open. More people had jobs. Farmers were doing better. And poor people were not so close to disaster as before. However, conditions were far from perfect. 10 million workers still did not have jobs. Young people leaving school were lucky to find any job at all. And most business owners were only earning small profits, if any at all. After the worst crisis was past, some groups of Americans began to attack Roosevelt and his programs. Conservatives were the first to break with the president. They accused Roosevelt of socialist economic policies.
Much more serious to Roosevelt was criticism from reformers within his own party. A number of popular leaders with strong ideas began to attract support from large numbers of Americans. Roosevelt saw his national unity falling apart. Conservatives were accusing him of socialism. Leftist opponents said he was doing too little to end the Depression. He saw that he had to change his path. Roosevelt knew he had little chance to regain the support of conservative Americans. His policies were too progressive. So, halfway through his first term as president, he began to support new reforms in an effort to win more support from the left.
The Supreme Court made the president's efforts easier. Early in 1935, the court ruled that several of Roosevelt's earlier programs violated the Constitution and ordered an end to them. Among them were major programs for farmers and industrial planning. The court's decisions forced Roosevelt to create new programs and try new ideas. One of his first new actions was to support a plan for government controls on companies that supplied water and produced electricity. Another was a measure to give jobs to workers. A third new law forced companies doing business with the federal government to pay workers a minimum wage. And the government also began enforcing a new law to control the actions of stock market traders and investment companies. At the same time, Roosevelt began to attack large companies. He spoke about the importance of small businesses in a democracy. He warned the nation that large companies had too much power. And he called for new actions to increase business competition and control large companies.
Roosevelt supported and Congress passed two laws during this period that would change the lives of working Americans for years to come. The first law gave more power to labor unions. The second created a federal system to provide money for workers after they retired. Roosevelt's administration had already supported labor unions in an earlier law, but that law was overruled by the Supreme Court. So, in 1935, the Congress passed a new law called the National Labor Relations Act. The act created a National Labor Relations Group to help negotiate agreements between workers and business owners. It gave all workers the right to join or form a labor union, and it ordered business owners to negotiate with a union if it represented most of the workers. The new law, for the first time, gave unions real power and negotiating rights.
The other very important law passed during this period created the National Social Security System. The law forced every worker and business owner to pay a small amount of money each month to the federal government. In exchange, the government paid money to workers who had retired or lost their jobs. The new law did not serve everyone. Farmers, government workers, and a number of other groups were not included in the system. The plan also did nothing to help people who were already unemployed. A person had to have a job after the new system began and then lose it to get money. However, the National Social Security law established a system that would grow and become a central part of American life.
Roosevelt also supported other new laws during this period that changed the American economy. A banking act gave the nation's central bank, the Federal Reserve Board, new power to control the total amount of money in use. Another law increased taxes for rich people. A third law limited the power of major companies to gain control of local electric utility companies. the new laws openly challenged the power of big companies, big banks, and big money. Roosevelt rejected the idea that government should cooperate with major companies. Instead, he accused many of the companies of ruining the economy and hurting the working man. He called on Congress to help small companies and the average American.
Perhaps the most important change during this period was that Roosevelt became willing to accept a federal budget that was not balanced. He began to agree with the ideas of Mariner Eccles, the head of the Federal Reserve Bank. Eccles believed that government had a duty to spend extra money during times of economic crisis. The extra money, he said, would create jobs for more people. They could buy more goods, and this would increase economic growth. Eccles believed that it was good policy for a government to spend more money than it earned through taxes during such periods. He argued that a growing economy would increase wages and bring in more tax money.
Roosevelt's administration had spent more money than it earned ever since it took office. But the president and his advisors did so only to end the economic crisis. They believed that it was a necessary evil. But Eccles and others told Roosevelt that it was not bad for the nation if the government spent more than it earned. The British economist John Maynard Keynes published an influential book that supported the same policy. And Roosevelt and his top advisors began to accept the new idea.
Roosevelt's economic policies were known as the New Deal. But the many changes he made during this period became known as the Second New Deal. They included some of the most important pieces of legislation in the history of the country, such as the National Labor Relations Act and the Social Security Law. And Roosevelt's willingness to accept an unbalanced budget would be the first step toward federal budget deficits that would grow steadily in the years to come. Budget deficits would jump under President Lyndon Johnson during the war in Vietnam. They would be an important cause of economic inflation in the United States and the world in the 1970s. And Americans would elect Ronald Reagan president in 1980, partly to try to bring federal spending under control. In 1935, however, most Americans agreed with Franklin Roosevelt that budget deficits were necessary to fight the serious economic depression.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.